Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I have the pleasure to discuss about an upcoming paper by three Bruegel colleagues on COVID-19 credit support programs. What has been the track record? What are the big issues? Which is really one of the big debates currently also in the EU, in the ECOFIN, in the Eurogroup. There was a discussion among ministers this week here in Brussels, or let's say here in Zoom, which really focused on exactly the question of whether support given to companies is appropriate, whether we need more support, perhaps more equity support, at what stage we should end equity support, governments should end equity support, at what stage governments should stop supporting credit, giving subsidized loans to companies, and how to manage and when to manage the exit from the extraordinary support programs that all EU countries have given to companies in the EU. And of course, not only in the EU, but also globally. And this debate was very, very active last year. It has been a little bit more quiet in the last couple of months, but I think it's an important debate that is now re-emerging, and we want to take a deeper look into this topic. And the paper that will be published by Bruegel these days really zooms in on what has been done and provides, I think, a very good overview of what has been done and what have been the implications. And we want to hear first from one of the co-authors of the paper, Julia Anderson, what are the key findings and key messages in the paper? And then we want to engage, of course, in the debate with all co-authors of the paper, so also Francesco Papadia and Nicolas Veron, on the paper more specifically, but also the broader issue that I think is of high policy relevance at the moment. Without much further ado, let me first give the floor to you, Julia, to present some of the key findings. And of course, Nicolas and Francesco, let's make it a lively discussion that our audience, our listeners, enjoy the back and forth between all of us. Let me give the floor to you first. Julia, please.
Thank you, Guntram. So just to give a bit of background, a credit support program can be a lot of things. But on average, it's a program by which the central government will counter-guarantee loans issued by banks via the intermediary of a national promotional bank. So for instance, in Germany, the KfW, which is a national promotional bank, will guarantee a loan that's been agreed to by a bank, and the central government will counter guarantee KfW's liabilities. So in the early days of the COVID crisis, we witnessed huge amounts being allocated to those credit support programs, loan guarantee programs. So for instance, in Germany, there were announcements that more than 750 billion would be allocated to credit support. And that compares, for instance, to 50 billion for grants to businesses. I mean, of course, credit support is mostly for firms. I should also clarify that. So the first interesting question is, how are those designed? How are those design choices different per country? For instance, we saw that under the Spanish program, the guarantees would only cover around 70% of the loans issued by banks, while that guarantee coverage went up to 100% in a few other countries. And so we first tracked how those programs were designed, and it was very fast moving. Those choices were made very fast because speed was of the essence, of course. And then we were interested in tracking how those programs would be taken up by firms to see, first of all, if the design choices had any impact on how attractive the proposition was for companies or for banks who are intermediary there. And so, you know, we're almost a year in now, and what we see is that the programs have seen very different levels of usage across countries. So for instance, in Germany, it's around the equivalent of 1% of GDP that has been committed under those credit support programs, while in Spain, it's 9% of GDP. So how do you explain that? What we can conclude for now is that it doesn't look like the design choices had an enormous impact on how much has been spent under the programs. It looks like the determining factor is GDP loss. So economic loss is strongly correlated with the actual usage of the program. So this would seem to suggest that, okay, there's some sort of natural proportion under which, by which firms take up this support. We share those results with different governments in the countries we've studied, different government authorities. And an important feedback we received is that it's also important to look at those measures in the context of all the measures. And there it appears that, you know, even though there's a strong correlation between GDP loss and the usage of the program, that usage doesn't necessarily compensate for much lower disbursement in other types of programs to support businesses, like grants, like short-time work schemes, etc. So it's been an important measure, but not necessarily one that has been able to fully complement lower spendings in some countries under different types of programs.
So Julia, just to interrupt you here and push you a bit. So what we are seeing is basically there has been, of course, a major economic shock, a major stress to the balance sheets of companies across the EU, across the world, but you studied the EU. And as these companies face stress, they need to take up credit. And the credit is basically subsidized by governments, meaning the governments guarantee the possible losses on these credits. But you find very different take-ups in these programs, and they are not determined by design choice, but really by the size of the shock. But that you determine based on macro numbers, not based on individual company numbers. Let's turn to Francesco, perhaps to add to the findings before we then move to more policy debate.
I think that in addition to what Julia said, one can say that these programs worked. Overall, they worked. We do examine how different they were, how different governments dealt with the trade-offs that are implicit in this program in different ways. But I think our overall judgment, and these programs worked, and worked as a kind of a first aid solution. I mean, they avoided the destruction that could have come out from downs that were needed because of COVID. However, I would also say that these programs are over. The time of this program is over. Now you have to think about new things. And in particular, the new things would have to take care of two different aspects that emerge from our analysis. The first one, no more debt. No more debt is needed for these firms. Something different is needed. And indeed, I mean, these firms, since last June, are not taking more debt. I mean, there was a burst of taking, and then it more or less plateaued since the summer. And the second thing, the direction in which this has to change is selectivity. I mean, it was urgent to do things quickly to avoid the death for many firms. Now it's needed to think which firms really have a good future ahead of them, which was not so much the issue until now. I mean, the programs were a bit different from this point of view. The risk of zombification was a bit higher for some programs than for others, but that was not the overriding concern. The overriding concern was put a bottom to the crisis. But now, no more debt and more selectivity are needed.
So, Nicola, more selectivity now, is that the message we should pass to policymakers from your point of view?
Well, before we get to that debate, I want to emphasize that this is not what the paper is about. The paper is basically backward-looking, looking at 2020, and looking at the credit support programs in 2020 in those five countries, and only those five countries, by the way, so Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom, in lots of detail. And our ambition for this paper is really that it should be the reference point on those programs, because we are not aware that anybody else has looked at those programs in the kind of cross-country comparative basis that we did, with that degree of detail and accuracy also in the numbers, but also the description of the program design and the design choice. And when we say, you know, it doesn't seem to be driven by design, we really looked hard at that. And we have a lot of discussion on these different parameters and the different yardsticks on which we can try to find causalities. I wouldn't say it's a definitive study, because I think that will take more time and come from academia, but it's we have tried to give as good a first draft of history, if you will, as we could within that time frame.
Can you just say one word on the design?
There are many design features. Who is eligible? For example, the naughty question of how far you go into, you know, companies that have difficulties. So how inclusive is the framework? So it's not just a matter of size. And then just the modalities, right? I mean, what's the interest rate? What's the amount guaranteed? As Julia said, it varies across programs from a low of about 70% to a high of 100% in some cases. And there are lots of different quirks, and we really go into the full discussion of that. The other thing I think that really jumps from the paper, and Julia said a bit about that, is that the take-up of the programs, what we call the usage, which is the actual volume of loans that banks have committed on the basis of actual applications by companies. This is very different from the headline numbers that were announced at the beginning when the programs were first launched. So, for example, Germany announced a huge envelope for its program, and very little of this has actually been used. So that discrepancy between the headline announcements and the actual usage or take-up is one of the big things that we highlight in the paper. I think most people are aware of that difference, but not everybody is aware of it. And there are still a lot of analysis that still quote the headline announcements as if that was the reality of the national credit support programs. And our paper basically screams, that's not the case. The reality of take-up is completely uncorrelated to the headline announcements and the kind of political rhetoric that went with it. It is also uncorrelated, and that's perhaps more interesting, with what we could call, you know, fiscal stress or fiscal constraint or just sovereign indebtedness. We don't find at all that member states have been constrained by fiscal considerations. So even the most, you know, the countries you would think of as most fiscally constrained with high debt, with difficult fiscal situations going forward, that doesn't seem to have obviously constrained the actual take-up of those credit support measures, even if to a certain extent it did constrain the headline announcements. So that's a very important and positive message, because that means that, you know, the kind of spread compression and what the ECB did and Next Generation EU, all the action at the macro level last year to make sure that we wouldn't have a fragmentation of the market when it comes to actual corporates and especially SMEs in terms of their funding access, this worked. It worked very well. So basically, you remember during the Eurozone crisis, there were all those stories of the hotels on either side of the Austro-Italian border, and the Italian hotel couldn't find credit and the Austrian hotel had plenty of it. We don't see that in the operation of those programs. So I'll stop there because much more to discuss on 2021 and looking forward. But I think on the backward-looking aspect, which is really what we have tried to do with the cutoff at the end of 2020, these are important lessons and things that policymakers should keep in mind.
Thank you, Nicola. And it's good to sort of highlight a bit more the paper and the finding for 2020. But let me push you a little bit on the reasons of the low take-up. I mean, one explanation that Julia gave was it's related to the size of the macro shock, the take-up. Now, another interpretation is, of course, also that the macro insurance that these kind of umbrella programs deliver, the headline number delivers, in a sense, it's in itself causes low take up. So the bigger the headline number you announce, the less companies need to pick it up because basically the insurance is out there and that helps stabilize expectations.
I'm personally skeptical about this because I think either the company needs fresh money or it doesn't. And yes, there has been a lot of precautionary access to those programs in some cases, but I think you also had a lot of distress in the corporate sector, including, I mean, in all member states that we look at. So I think, you know, to the extent those programs offered favorable conditions for accessing credit, I think a cautious entrepreneur would look at that and take it when they feel they might need it. Because, you know, the government may have made a big announcement, but who knows what they will do next month. So I think we see the precautionary behavior in all member states. We see it in the fact that a lot of the take-up, with the important exception of Italy, took place in the first few months, even the first few weeks in a way. And I wouldn't overemphasize the psychological aspects, but maybe my co-authors have different views.
Well, let me give perhaps one word to Francesco first, to Julia, if there's anything on sort of the backward-looking analysis that you think still needs to be emphasized in the paper, because you've done a lot of the granular data work. And, you know, we would love to hear from you if there's sort of one more aspect on 2020 before we then move on to discuss 21. I mean, I think one question perhaps I can throw at you is, you mentioned one issue you mentioned is other support measures and the extent that other support measures influence the take up of the credit. And one issue that has been discussed was, for example, not just credit support, but fixed cost support. I know that Germany provided to companies basically a lump sum that is covering some fixed cost, which was very helpful in a situation where with lots of uncertainty and might have reduced also the take up of credit support, because you basically you got 100,000 grant without any justification needed. And so then you just take that and that's your insurance for the moment. I mean, is that one feature you looked at or any other aspect you want to emphasize?
Yeah, so we looked at the complementary support to see if there was this complementarity or not. And indeed, in the case of Germany, what's interesting is that the very low numbers are driven by low take up among SMEs. So in all other countries, SMEs account for about 75% of the take up in terms of volume. In Germany, only 50%. And the reason we explain that is that the grants have been very generous. But then on the other hand, we look at Spain and there the complementary grant type programs have not been as generous as they have been in Germany, for instance. But it doesn't mean that firms took out more loans. So there seems to be a capacity for firms to take on debt that's constrained. And to add to Nicola's point, and I guess also Francesco's about the curve, the fact that the take-up was initially really strong and then it kind of converged. There's anecdotal evidence that a lot of the funds that have been taken up are still sitting on bank accounts. So there has been indeed a lot of precautionary saving. We would like some hard data on that, but we haven't been able to get our hands on it.
Okay, Francesco, let's move to you. You already started discussing a bit sort of the policy lessons and what should be done now and, you know, where should we move now? And I think the two points you mentioned were we need something different and we should phase out perhaps because we can't support forever. But perhaps you can just enlarge a little bit more on sort of the forward-looking element. Where do you see currently the debate and where would you like it to be? And then we see Nicola, and perhaps he has contrasting views.
I think that there is a table in the report that says how countries, or how our five countries, have positioned themselves on the different trade-offs that existed in designing the programs. And if Mario Draghi, the new prime minister of Italy, asked me, is there anything in your paper that could help me design the program of my government? I would say, yes, look at the table in which it is shown that Italy has run the more risk in terms of the zombification of its firms. So this is a risk that is everywhere. If you give money, you risk giving money to firms that have no future. But according to the very granular analysis to which Nicola referred, and which is, we must say, the merit of Giulia, you see that our assessment is that Italy is the one that runs more risk in this respect. And of course, we know that Italy is exactly the country that, because of its ossified productive structure, hasn't had any growth of productivity for the last 20 years. So if I was Draghi, I would say, oh, that's interesting information. I should do something very specific in terms of the continuation of these programs. So this is a way in which our backward-looking analysis to which Nicola referred to could be useful in thinking about the future.
So Nicola, let Italian zombified firms fail and we are sure we can identify the right ones at this stage?
Well, you know, it's a difficult and it's not new, right? You remember the famous quote from the Treasury Secretary of Herbert Hoover during the Great Depression, you know, liquidate labor, liquidate farming, liquidate companies that have no future, and that will lead to a lot of economic renewal. And that kind of Darwinian take in a severe downturn, we know is not the optimal course. Actually, it can be catastrophic. So finding the right balance between the need for economic renewal and the need to preserve economic structures that have a future is extremely difficult. And it's even more difficult because we don't know much about the future that those companies will face. Think of, for example, you know, city centers. Will city centers thrive again, or will they become less active because people prefer to live and work in the suburbs or in the countryside? This kind of questions, nobody has a clear answer at this point. We just don't know. And therefore, which business have a future in that sense, there is huge uncertainty and there is a risk of too much disruption, I think, which remains completely there in 2021 as it was in 2020. As I said, the paper doesn't try to answer those questions. The paper is about 2020. So here we're about personal opinions. If you ask me, I'm not going to try to speak on behalf of Mario Draghi or for that matter, Emmanuel Macron or any other leader, but I think that we would like to have some shift from debt to equity. Right? I mean, you look at the corporate balance sheets and they look extended and there's a lot of debt. And it is tempting to say that should be rebalanced and that means conversion of debt to equity or some form of rebalancing. The question is, how do you do that in practice? I mean, it's a fine slogan in theory. If you look at it in practice, what does that mean? Does that mean that the state gets equity? Does that mean that the banks get equity? Does that mean that some public bank gets equity? None of this is very appealing. And particularly having the banks get equity create a lot of fragility in the banking sector. And I certainly wouldn't go the way of making it easier in terms of risk weighting and capital regulation. That would be very imprudent. And also having the state get equity, even in the form of hybrid debt that could convert into equity if things go wrong, is very problematic, as we know. And frankly, I think a lot of SME owners don't want that at all. And they could also abuse it and make it, you know, a ripoff of the taxpayer if that's not carefully formulated. So I see more problems and solutions here. And my kind of frustrated intermediate conclusion is that, you know, debt levels are high, but they probably have a way to go higher. And we're in a state of low rates. That means that more leverage can be achieved than under, you know, high policy rate circumstances. So that leads us, of course, to the discussion of what happens in the U.S. Is there overheating in the U.S.? Could that in the U.S. increase? What is the read across the Eurozone? Lots of macro debates. But at this point, I don't see an easy fix that would have the same clarity in 2021 as the credit support programs we studied had in 2020. And I want to say it again, they were very successful in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, let me, Francesco, add also there. I mean, I'm quite close to Nicola on these issues. I mean, I think the notion of Schumpeterian destruction doesn't really apply to the current situation because the current situation is characterized by profound changes that are really externally driven. I mean, they are not driven by firm-specific issues. They are driven by a severe external health crisis. And so in that sense, I feel a little bit awkward letting firms, deciding now which firms to let go. Now then, I agree also that it would be nice to have more equity.
You mean letting governments or banks deciding, right?
Exactly. So then there's the equity part where I also have sort of doubts how we can put the equity into companies, especially the small ones. But I do sense that, you know, we might need to move beyond sort of just lending guarantees. We might have to include some form of transfer elements to some companies because those companies, I mean, even though debt is cheap, relatively cheap, the debt level still matters. And at some stage, it becomes perhaps very constraining. But Francesco, how would you react to those points?
What I'm saying is not that I want a completely different approach. I even said that approach that we started in all details worked. It was appropriate. It did the right things. What I'm saying is that we cannot keep this approach just the same. It has to change. And one of the changes, I think, is thinking more as far as we can about which firms are likely to improve in the future. I mean, we know that bankruptcies have been very, very limited in historical terms just because there was a lot of support, credit support, but also moratoria and other kinds of support. So it's not that we want the Darwinian process to now start and disrupt everything, just avoid that the Darwinian process is completely muted and taken out of the picture by a continuation of indiscriminate support. So it's a matter of emphasis, it's a matter of design, it's a matter of fine-tuning the measures, not going with an axe and saying, okay, now all the firms that cannot survive, they better go to the graveyard.
I think we are coming to the close of our conversation, but let me perhaps throw one last quick question to you and get a very quick take from each of you on that. So suppose we can't get vaccination done quickly enough and the tourism season will not really work out this summer. What does it really take to keep the small and medium-sized enterprises in the Mediterranean countries, let's call it by its name, so Greece, Italy, some parts of France and Spain and Portugal also. What does it really take to preserve the tourism sector in these countries? Nicola?
Well, I strongly object to calling Portugal a Mediterranean country, but,
I concur with that one, actually. it faces the same problem.
Yeah, of course, as we said before, our paper by choice is only about large countries, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom. So we don't have data for the smaller ones. But to your question, I think it is inevitable that there will be some more corporate restructuring. And I think that cannot be delayed forever. So I think, for example, lifting the moratoria is probably a good idea because it makes credit assessment extremely difficult, and that can create also fragility in the banking sector. So I wouldn't advise endless extension of moratoria. I could see a little bit more credit support down the line, even if that means more indebtedness. And I could see, frankly, more direct support in the form of grants or debt relief or tax burden relief in one form or another. And this is politically contentious, of course, because it's a transfer, but even so, it happens only domestically. But I think inevitably there will be a need for that component. Frankly, I think if you think in kind of broad terms, quantitative, especially for the SME space, I think we'll see more credit extension and direct fiscal support than anything that would look like equity injections for the reasons we discussed before. And I think the challenge will be balancing all this. And that will require a lot of case-by-case judgment. I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all recommendation there.
Julia, do you want to add something?
Yeah, maybe something just a bit more anecdotal. I'm here in Spain and I see those small tourist shops being closed, and I speak to people my age and, you know, that's their career, but now they don't have it anymore. And so they're on unemployment or they're choosing to do something different. So at this point, it's about thinking what, Guntram, you've written about, which is youth unemployment, and how do you reskill? Maybe it's very tendential, but it seems important as well.
Thank you. Francesco?
Of course, as we said, saying which sector will do fine, which sector will suffer, is very difficult. But for instance, tourism and office buildings. Well, I think it's a safe bet to say that tourism will return to where it was. Office building, probably not. So a non-residential real estate will probably suffer on a persistent basis. I don't know whether permanent, but surely on a persistent basis. So supporting sector like tourism, for instance, Nicolas said, tax burden relief, grants, maybe makes more sense than supporting a commercial real estate. And I think with some effort, you can make this kind of very broad differences and target your action accordingly.
Okay, I think very, very big and important judgments that policymakers will have to make in the next months, certainly controversial judgments. What our paper and your paper delivers, I think, is really a sound basis for taking these decisions. And of course, as always, we love to engage with our audience on these issues. So if you have questions or comments or remarks, don't hesitate to write to the authors. And until next time, thank you for joining us. And thank you, Julia. Thank you, Francesco. Thank you, Nicola, for the great presentation and the great paper, as well as the great policy discussion. Until next time, bye-bye.